This is On and Off Your Mat podcast, episode 223, From Punk to Monk, a journey of self-discovery and transformation. If you've ever felt like something was missing from your life, like you were longing for more connection, wholeness, pleasure, or, you know, love with a capital L, today's episode is for you. For today's episode, I sat down with Raghunath Das, earlier known as Ray Kapo. Raghunath has been on a spiritual quest his whole life. He's an ex-punk, ex-monk. He practices and teaches bhakti yoga, other teachers as well, and he's a spiritual storyteller. He's the co-host of the podcast Wisdom of the Sages and the author of the book From Punk to Monk, a memoir. We sat down to talk about his story of stepping out of mainstream society as a punk artist and later in life as a monk to find truth, joy, and purpose, and about the big questions of life we encounter when we are on a journey of self-discovery and transformation, and we are looking for deeper meaning. If this episode inspires you in any way, share it and help someone else on their journey towards remembering who they are and what matters. I really love to read your takeaways on each episode. So take a screenshot of the episode, share something you've learned or inspired you, and tag me on Instagram, either at On and Off Your Mat Podcast or erica.belanger. And I'll be happy to see it and reshare it for you. All right. If you're ready to jump into today's episode with Raghunath, let's go. It's going to be a good one. Hi, Raghunath.
How are you? Good to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm excited about our discussion.
Good to see you in Costa Rica.
Can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your journey for listeners that don't know you yet or don't know you very well?
Okay. So I do a podcast called Wisdom of the Sages. It's a daily podcast on yoga philosophy. And I got into a yoga spiritual journey in my teens when I was living in New York City as a singer of a hardcore straight edge punk band called Youth of Today. Mm-hmm. And the band sort of took off in the midst of a crazy punk world of the Lower East Side of New York City in the 80s, which if you don't know New York City in the 80s, it was like artistic and tragic and dangerous and cool and a cool place to be. And there was the Beastie Boys and Madonna and Run DMC and hardcore and alternative art and street art. And it was just all happening. And it was also in the background was chaos, crooked police. And so it was an interesting place to sort of like grow up around and be part of that subculture. And the band, although it was like really raw and intense, we were spiritual seekers, and I was a spiritual seeker. And I, from a young age, I gave up taking any types of intoxicants or smoking and became a serious vegetarian, which at that time was very peculiar. Now it's like you can go to Burger King and get a vegan burger. But back then it was like, you're what? You're not going to eat that?
That was radical for sure.
It was very radical in 1984, 1985. And so as the band got big and my diving into spiritual philosophy, because I really started getting into broad-minded understanding of spirit outside of exclusive religiosity or Abrahamic religions, I really got drawn to Eastern thought. And I thought like, yeah, everybody has God within them. Even all animals have God within them, and all plants have gods, and even the planets are spiritual. And I started getting into Ayurvedic medicine. At that time was even more bizarre than yoga. There was one book on Ayurvedic medicine, but I met an Ayurvedic doctor. That started my journey into how to eat healthy as a vegetarian, because I didn't know anything about eating healthy. All I knew is I didn't want to eat animals anymore. All I knew, I have grown up in an Italian Catholic household that ate meat every day.
Yep.
So anyway, that was part of my journey of finding myself when I was 18. And then my father died sort of unexpectedly. And as the band's success grew and my father died, it just put me on a whole spinning out of control and sort of accelerated my spiritual pursuits. And at 22, I quit. I went to India. I became a monk. I lived in ashrams all around the world and stayed in an ashram for about 6.5 years. And that was a whole chapter of my life. That makes up my adventures through India and America and restarting a band while living in an ashram and touring the world with that. And all my like life lessons. So that's in my book. You can get it on Amazon. You can even get it on Audible for those who can't read books any longer.
That don't have the attention span to sit with the book.
Well, we're pretty sad species, aren't we? It's just getting worse and worse. Soon it's just going to be just graphic novels. That's the only thing we'll be able to read. So that's sort of my story. Then I was an international yoga teacher for a while. And now I do this daily yoga podcast on yoga philosophy. And I take groups of people traveling to India, holy places, Nepal, holy places, and lead trainings in India every year.
It's a very different journey than most yoga teachers or spiritual seekers today. Do you think there's a common thread between the punk subculture and spirituality, or are they two things that actually have friction between them?
They can be. For me, it really was, because the punk culture, you know, you got to understand the context of punk culture in the 80s. Everything was arena rock and corporate. Every type of music was. The only way to listen to this type of music was you stayed up late on a Tuesday night at 11 p.m. and there's a college radio station that would play this type of counterculture music, which was everything from weird garage rock, rockabilly, you know, anything that major corporate radio stations would not play. And punk and hardcore were part of that. And so sometimes these bands would put out a record, they would only make 1,000 records. So everything was like underground. And there was always a handful of people in every state in America that were sort of into this type of music. But you had to be like an archaeologist and dig it out and find out where it was playing and find out where the clubs were, where these bands would play. And so you'd really have to do a lot of sort of homework. It connected you with all the other freaks out there that weren't interested in going to the Jay Giles concert. And so in that sense, you had to step away from mainstream society. And I think also with my spiritual pursuit, I had to sort of step away from my society as well, because I grew up in a loving Catholic Italian family, but they weren't having it. Like, they were like, you're going to do what? You're going to become a Krishna devotee and live in an airport and distribute flowers on the street? That's what you're talking about? And so it was like really shocking. It was shocking the fact that I gave up meat. In my household, when my parents grew up in the Depression in New York City, for them, it was like eating meat was a sign of we've made it out of the ghetto. Now we can afford meat, you know? And I was like, no, I don't want to eat your meat. And everybody was like, I know this sounds silly now because everybody's a vegetarian, you know, or a vegan or animal rights conscious, or it's at least in the conversation in the schools. But then it was like heresy for my Italian family. And so you had to just sort of like, you know what? I'm just going to figure it out myself. And of course, there is like, I don't want to go to university like all my siblings are doing. I want to go to India and search for God. That was another, you had to really be able to say, you know what? I know you don't approve people what I'm doing. Plus, I had fans and friends that were all fans of my band. And I basically had a movement of these other kids that followed me in my teens that were, we don't drink, we don't smoke, we're into animal rights. And so you could really like wave a flag of sort of like self-betterment behind that. It's a good cause. For me, it just wasn't enough. And I was like, okay, love y'all. Goodbye. And I sort of like just walked away from everything. I also owned a record label at the time, which I ended up just giving to my partner and said, I'm not interested in business. I need to find God at this point in my life. And so, yeah, it took a lot of sort of my spiritual path did take me very similar on a punk rock path.
Yeah.
You could draw the parallel.
It's like two very different paths, but at the same time, you experience your connection to other people and like what's expected from you in society in the kind of similar way, because it was radical to be vegetarian. It was radical to be in yoga. It's still radical to decide to move to an ashram and live there, you know, or travel through ashram. Like, that's still a radical choice for people to do in their life today.
People give you hell. Like, when I was in high school, people gave me hell. Now everybody dyes their hair blue. It's like normal. You go into a Walmart and the cashier's got blue hair. If you had an earring in 1982.
Yeah, you were pushing the envelope.
Yeah, you're going to get your ass kicked by the end of the day by somebody. And that's just the way, you know, you roll.
Yeah.
You're taking your life into your own hands. At least in my high school, I was the object of torture, getting made fun of. That's just what happened on a regular basis. And of course, even in the punk scene, you got hell. You got lots of hell. Like, wait a second. You're going to sing about God in the punk scene?
Yeah.
How dare you? This is punk. We don't follow any rules. And then I'd always have to come back and say, well, if there's no rules, then I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
I'm going to take your no rules and I'm going to sing about God.
That is so interesting because I didn't think of that little piece, but it's in every aspect. It's like you embrace something, but you also kind of went a step further into the other side of things. Like, you're in the punk culture, but you're also, you know, practicing moderation and you're not drinking and you're not, you know, and then
there's never been peace for me.
I love this. You said that there was something that was not enough, that you were seeking God. What was missing in your life at that point? What were you hoping to find by leaving the band, by leaving the record company and going into, I'm starting this new life?
I think there just comes a time in a person's life, and maybe not everybody's life, where you realize there is nothing of this world that will satisfy my heart. There's no person that will make me whole. I know we've created this whole Hollywood world where she is my soulmate and I found her, we connected. If I could only find my soulmate, and how can I even exist without my soulmate when I know they're out there? And we've created this idea that we're selling to the world that if you just have the right person, that's what you're missing out on. And unfortunately, I witnessed that in my family, in my parents. I thought, well, they had the right person. And then my father died. So I was like, well,
now what?
What can we hold on to that is not going to get taken away from me? That was sort of what was coming up for me again and again. What can I fall in love with that I won't lose? That was an ongoing theme. How can I have lasting pleasure in a temporary world? We all want pleasure. We're pleasure seeking.
That's a big question for a 22-year-old.
It haunted me before I was 22, but it sort of accelerated by the time I hit 22. And especially because I did have some success. And I realized even with my success, it's like, well, I'm not Michael Jackson. We had tens of thousands of followers and I'd get fan mail and we could play in a weird city and everyone would know our lyrics. But I was like, I could get bigger. I could get much bigger, but I'm already sort of big. And I'm definitely not happier than I was before I wasn't big. When I was not big, I think I was more happy. So what do I need to get to this next tier? Like I'm playing a video game. And you're like, okay, now I'm level 7. Now I'm level 9. Do I have to get to level 15? Do I have to get to Michael Jackson's level to be fully appreciated and to feel fully whole and valid and connected? And so at the point I was at, I was like, there's no level of validation that will make me feel whole. There is no lover that would make me feel whole. And also, I just witnessed the material world. There is nothing purchase that will make me feel whole. I'm not saying don't drive a good car and have a shelter, but you see this, especially in wealthy countries. Where are we going with all the consumptions? Like, we're going to extend a room. We're going to redo our kitchen. And sometimes people, because I go to India a lot, they're like, why are they redoing their kitchen? Does their kitchen not work? Like their kitchen works great. It's outdated. They're going to update their kitchen.
It's out of fashion. Yeah.
And that's what'll happen. Americans will go in. Okay, we got to update this place. It's got nothing to do with the practicalness. All it is, and I read this in a book. I mentioned this in my book too. I was laying down reading books at the Shivananda Ashram in New York City. And there was this statement in one of Shivananda Maharaj's books was, try to note where your pleasure is coming from. Is it coming from pleasure of the self? Or pleasure of the ego. And I thought, all my pleasure is pleasure from the ego. The idea of why am I updating my kitchen, so to speak, is pleasure of the ego. So when you come over and say, oh, what a great range you have, or I love the chrome sink, or whatever it is, you know, I love the tiles. It's really just pleasure for my ego. It makes me feel more in control, better about myself. And when we start equating our value with our stuff, I find that to be a problem. We find our value to be our stuff, our value to be our job, even our value to be our family. It's not like those are things are evil, but when we equate our value to it, then we're setting ourselves up for pain, if not devastation, when we lose that value, when there's a stock market crash of your value. You see this a lot. A man has very beautiful hair, and all of a sudden they lose all their hair. They really thought, my hair was my value. Fortunately, I never had good hair. So when I lost my hair, it wasn't such a big
deal. It was not a big deal.
It was not a big deal. People do it. Women do it as they age, they lose their beauty. Whatever currency you've been using, we use our beauty, we use our looks, we use our strength, we use our intelligence, we use our stuff, we use an American Express platinum card, we use our inheritance, whatever we have been using, when that currency drops, like all currencies do, they fluctuate. When that currency goes down, then we suffer tremendously. And so what can I actually embrace? What can I actually lean into that won't get stripped away from me? Like, where do I find my happiness outside happiness of the ego? That was sort of like a burning question.
So where? Where do we find that happiness? Where do we find that love that is not external and related to our validation? Where do we find pleasure that is lasting independently of what's happening inside or outside of us rather, and the things being stripped away.
Those are the maha questions of the universe. And the sages of ancient India, they say you get it from connection. You get it from spiritual connection, not from your stuff. And your stuff you can use as a crutch, but it's just that. You have to let go of that crutch. You can be in the world, but once you're of the world, then when those crutches get taken away, you're setting yourself up for pain. So it's good to be aware of this stuff as we lose our stuff, because then it's less shocking. You know, I just had my 58th birthday. And to me, it's like, I don't even get it until someone asked me, how old are you? I was like, 58. I was like, yeah, that's like a real number. That's what you are. Remember when your dad was 58? It was horrible, wasn't it? Your old father. Now you're the old father, dude. And so it's one of these things that as, you know, the hands of time start to like prune us, this is gardening analogies, lop us from all of our stuff and all of our beauty and all of our strength and all of our wealth and all of our endurance. And then we start to figure out like, well, who am I anyway? What am I? And the yogis of ancient India say, you're an eternal spiritual being. That's your identity. You're born here to serve and give love and find deeper connection. And that's done through various types of practices, you know.
So that connection is one to ourself and that, you know, capital S self, and then through devotion.
Yes. Capital S self, right? I love that. I love how you said that, because I use that word a lot too. I say capital L love too, because I love my children, love my partner, you know, I love my car. I love things of this world. Even my kids are of this world. You know, I don't own my kids, like, but there are small L's still. It's a small L love. And I say small L, not because my kids are small, but because I can't possess them. You know, I can't possess the people of this world or the things of this world. If I could, I could keep them forever, and I can't. I can't even possess my own body. You know, the capital L love, we reserve the capital L love for our love with divinity, or our love with God, or our love with source. That's sort of like what we're doing as almost like archaeologists trying to dig around and find, where is that deeper connection? How can I embrace that in a deep way?
How can people do that if they're not in a place where they want to leave everything behind and go into an ashram? What's a daily thing that we can do to reconnect, to stay connected to that big capital S and to divine in whatever form that takes for you?
Well, in different traditions, they'll have different ways of doing it. And in the tradition of bhakti yoga, which is, you know, what I've been practicing, is you do it through regular hearing and speaking and associating. And hearing is a form of hearing, imbibing wisdom literature, which is not just philosophical. It's not just entertaining, but it's soul satisfying. And there's volumes and volumes of this type of wisdom literature. And this is what we specialize on our podcast.
I was just going to say, and this is what you're doing with the podcast and a bit what we're doing today as well.
Exactly. We're doing it right now. It wets your whistle for internal dialogue. It's dialogue and it's a fun conversation, but it also makes you ask another question. Like when we hang up this phone, so to speak, it'll bring up more questions.
Yeah, we're planting seeds for people to continue to think about their own experience of all of these things.
So it's not like the dialogue ever ends. And a matter of fact, the book that we study from in the podcast is 18,000 verses and 12 cantos, and we're only on canto 6, and we're not even halfway through it.
And you're like at the 1,200 something episodes.
Yeah, aren't you? We're on 1,200 episodes right now. And the whole book is a conversation book. It's conversations within conversations within conversations sometimes. And there are all these fantastic stories of what they would call the history of the universe, including kings on earth. It's an interesting thing, the story, because it's a book on what we would call in America the haves. We tend to think like, oh, the haves, it's the 1%, they have everything. But it's a story of kings and queens and their suffering. We tend to think the haves don't suffer. Everybody suffers. It's part of having a body. You don't get a pass from suffering. I'm not sure this is why it was specifically designed, but a lot of the stories within this book are of the haves and how they struggle and how they overcome the struggle. And when you hear about the lives of other people, and I'm sure it's true in your own life, when you hear about people who've just been through hell, and they somehow overcome it, it's sort of like...
It's inspiring.
Yeah, I want to do that.
You hope. You're like, oh, maybe that's available for me too.
Right, exactly. And so that's what we do. So you say, how do you do it? How do you find connection? We hear, we speak, we hear. We find the company of other people who are also into that. And we find that the company of the people we keep transforms us. The company of the people we keep either brings us higher or brings us lower, or brings us real high or brings us real low. I'm sure when I say that, you could probably think of a few people in your life that when you hang out with them, it's your best self doesn't manifest. Matter of fact, they might bring out the worst in you. We would say those people are actually not your friends, as friendly as they are, and they might make you laugh.
Yeah.
But in the big picture of things, if life does have a purpose and life is incredibly short, which it is in the bigger picture of things, then those people are diversions. And so it takes a type of strong appetite in your spiritual life for you to realize, you know what?
To step away.
I got to step away from this at a young age. At 22, I was like, you know what? This is over. This part of my life is dead. It's not going to help me any longer. I've grown out of these shoes, you know?
Yeah. So there was always that seeking for the something bigger and greater, and not in the sense of having more, like we were talking about, but in the sense of experiencing the fullness of what it means to be human.
You know, I think I was mentioning this when I did Joe Rogan too. There's a time when I first went to India and was living with the monks, and I realized, like, these guys have nothing. Why are they so happy? They've got nothing. Like, my whole culture is trying to desperately find something, purchase something, consume something, upgrade to something, just to get what these guys already have. And they're not even happy. They've upgraded their apartment. They've upgraded their condo. They moved to the beach.
Yeah, check, 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 check.
They checked all the boxes, and it's still like they're living somewhere in the future. And so it really drove me crazy. I was like, these guys have nothing and they're joyful. If I could learn this, if I could learn this art, like all their possessions fit in a milk crate? Come on. So anyway, that drove me like a more of a burning question. I was like, this is the art of living. They've cracked the code. And so that really inspired me too. When you see people can apply this stuff to their life and they have the joy that I think that people want. People want to be joyful. They'll do all type of things to be joyful. They'll join a gang to find camaraderie.
Belonging,
and,
yeah.
And belonging and friendship. And
I think it's part of human nature. Like, we're craving it no matter how we reach for it, even if it's in ways that hurt us in the end. We're still hoping that somewhere under that, you know, negative consequence it might bring in our life, there's still a taste for joy in it.
And I think that's why it's always got to be balanced out with, well, is this type of happiness bringing my consciousness higher? Is this type of happiness making me more happy with just being me? Is this type of company that I'm keeping, is it making me the best person I can be, right? Because you can find camaraderie in a gang, killing people.
Yeah.
But is it making you feel good about yourself? You know, I had a lot of friends, you know, gaggles of friends before I moved into an ashram. But I realized, like, I'm not sure I want to be like this. I want something higher. And that's the problem with reading books about exalted souls and great souls. It's like it raises the bar of, like, yeah, who you can become. And you think, you know what? I don't want to waste time. I don't want to sit around and watch boring, mundane movies or waste my time any longer. Life is short. Come on. I got to get serious about life. And that was sort of a driving force.
Yeah. We've talked about how struggle and then overcoming struggle is something we looked for in people and we get inspired with. What would you say was the struggle in that journey of leaving that life behind, becoming a monk, going to ashram? What did you overcome that brought you closer to that connection, that love, that pleasure that is more sustainable?
That's a good question. I think the ongoing struggle, it's quite like a climb of Everest, especially as you first face off with it, of course, is, I think traditions around the world will say this is the ego, is you've really invested in your body and your stuff and your charm and your charisma and your hair and your family or your position. We're so invested in the ego. And then as you go on that journey of self-discovery and you hear wisdom literature, which are sort of like markers, like if you're on the Appalachian Trail, there's like markers that you know, okay, you're on the trail or you're off the trail. So there's markers along the way. And part of the wisdom literature teaches, like, notice, like what I said earlier, what's pleasure of you and what's pleasure of the self? What's the real pleasure of your stuff and what's the pleasure of yourself? What's the pleasure of the ego? And so when you hear hints like that, you start to think, oh, I get it. I've been investing in this thing that has no return on investment.
Yes.
There's no return on this. I've been investing in the ego as the self. And it's heartbreaking because that's all I knew of myself was how I can manipulate people with words and my cleverness and my charm and my humor or my looks or my money or my whatever it was.
How you can get your way.
Yeah, this was my winning formula to get around in this world. Okay, maybe I'm not that beautiful. Maybe I'll use my humor. Maybe I'm not that funny. Maybe I'll use my money. Maybe I don't have that much money. Maybe I'll use my athletic ability. So as you face off with your ego, and your ego is super subtle, even as I lived in the ashram, I go to bed really early, wake up really early. There's an ego of like, I'm waking up before everybody. But the good thing is, after a while, you start to realize that the ego is not your enemy. You got to engage your ego in the real ego. There's a real ego. The real ego is I'm a spiritual being. And once you engage your external body in your spiritual life and your spiritual purpose, then the ego doesn't bother you anymore, because you're not what they say in the 80s. You're not fronting. You're not being someone you're not. You're not being pretentious of it, they say.
Yeah, you're not faking it.
You're not faking it. And that's one sign of people that are connected or spiritually connected or great souls or saints. You never feel like they're trying to put on a front, or they're trying to impress you, or they have some bravado or some persona that they're trying to show off.
That is a hard thing to let go of in our society, in our culture. It's not something easy to overcome, but yet tapping into that authenticity kind of brings us back to connecting to self. Like, it has to start there. You can't let the world see who you are if you're disconnected and you don't even feel and know who that self is.
We don't really have much of an option. That's the problem. We don't have much of an option. If I'm saying, well, I have to understand I'm not my hair. Well, I can't. My hair is quite beautiful. Look at my long, beautiful hair. And everyone says, Raghu, you got such beautiful hair. Oh, man, who's that guy with the great hair? Guess what? There's every chance I could lose that hair. At least in my old age, I could lose the hair. It's just not going to be as beautiful as it could. Or sometimes we see people lose all their wealth. I've had so many clients who've lost everything in hurricanes or in some type of tragedies. So here's the deal. It's like, if we don't prepare ourselves for reality, which is I'm small, I own nothing, I've come into this world with nothing, all I can do is actually give love and I can't possess anything. If you don't rally behind that truth, you're setting yourself up for disaster. Because everything that we have, every king in the history of the world has lost everything. It's just the way the world works.
I'm letting people take this in for a second.
It is. It's the real conversation. It's sometimes a horse pill to swallow, isn't it? That I don't even own my own body. And parents get that. Like, parents, when their kids turn like 13, at least in America, like, I don't know what you were like when you were 13. Or
disaster. Yeah.
Like, in India, it's not like that. The kids are very respectful to their parents. I was blessed with very respectful kids. But, you know, when I was a kid, I was just like, I'm out of here. I was like doing my own thing, go to New York City when I was 14. I loved my parents, but I was doing my own thing and didn't tell them what I was doing. And if they knew what I was doing, they'd lose their minds. Kids at sometimes they just go, you know, screw you, mom. I'm going to go smoke cigarettes. Screw you, mom. I'm going to hang out with my friends tonight. And the parents lose control. And so parents can really lose it as their kids start moving away from them. At one point in their life as a parent, they were like, my kid does everything. He loves me. He talks to me. He mimics me. He wants to be like me when he grows up. And then something switches and they're like, I want to stay as far away from dad as possible. And you're like, hey, son, let's go to the supermarket together. And they're like, no way. Let's go on vacation. They don't want to go on vacation with you anymore. There comes a time in a kid's life very often and the parents are devastated.
It feels like a rejection of who you are, you know? I assume.
Well, I know a lot of other teenagers, they go through a natural thing where they have to rebel against their parents.
You have to create your own identity in this world, you know?
You have to find your own identity. Sometimes it's in almost a cruel way. I can't remember what the movie was. It was about this guy who raised turkeys, these abandoned baby turkeys, and they followed him around everywhere. And it was like this beautiful love affair between this man and these turkeys. And then at a certain age, the turkeys were cruel to him as they had to find their own identity as alpha males. And it was like the most heartbreaking documentary ever.
And like reconnecting to their inner wildness, which we can do as human as well. We're quite disconnected from our own wildness.
We have a statement of let's spend more time outdoors, which means, what are you talking about? We are beings of outdoorsness, that we have to actually call it spending more time outdoors. We have to make a phrase for it. Yeah, it's quite insane, isn't it?
It is, for sure. You were mentioning in the beginning of the book, which we're not talking, you know, directly about, but it's kind of the context of our conversation, From Punk to Monk. It's a memoir. Was the idea of writing a memoir about inspiring other people in their own self-discovery and transformation? Because it's a story of self-discovery and transformation. Is it about inspiration or is it about something different?
You know, it was interesting because I wanted to do another book, a different book, a sort of a self-help journey and sort of make bhakti, yoga, philosophy a little bit more palatable and understandable for the masses. But my publisher was like, well, I think you should write your story. I was like, my story? I don't have a good story. I wasn't a drug addict. I lived a clean life. I was like never in jail. I was like, no one wants to hear my story. And they're like, you got a pretty good story. Just write your story. I was like, well, here's my other idea. They're like, oh, those are great ideas, but we want you to write your story. So they sort of like muscled me into it. And then I was like, I'm not quite as organized in the mind as I'd like to be. So I did this myself. I didn't do it with a ghostwriter, but I did it in little tiny chunks of my life. And then they were like, this is great, but you're missing huge, you know, bridges from one landmass to another. So go back and from A to K, you're missing B, C, D, E, F, like that. And so I had to go back and make the arc happen. And then they cut out 200 pages of my good stories. And they were like, well, you don't need this. So we had like really three editors on this book, cutting and trimming. And I'm happy with it right now. Actually, by mistake, someone wrote me and like, oh, I love your book. It's out on Audible now. I was like, you're kidding. It wasn't supposed to be out now. And so I purchased it and then called the publisher and they were like, oh my God, it wasn't supposed to be out. So they withdrew all the copies. But if you bought it, you could have it. So there's so many people I know bought it on Audible, but I did. And I just actually loved just listening to it from beginning to end. And it was a nice arc. And like you said, when you read someone's spiritual journey, it's not to make them follow your spiritual journey and your steps, but to inspire them on their spiritual journey. And it's going to look different for each one of us because we're each like a fingerprint in this world, a unique fingerprint, a unique signature in this world. I'm hoping, that's my prayer, that you know you find some connection to your inner self through my journey. And yeah, it was a fun story to read, you know, the wacky hijinks of a teenager from the streets of New York trying to figure out life in India and abroad and then starting a punk band in an ashram and then going to India regularly to check in with, you know, mystics and teachers and palm readers and just the whole gamut that life was.
I feel, and that's probably why they wanted you to write that book. Although it's a very particular and unique story, it's also a very universal story of soul searching, of searching for what matters.
You don't have to be a punk, hardcore, straight edge vegan to find your own self in there as well, too. Because like you were saying, there's part of everybody that wants to reconnect with even more than a soulmate, I think. Like every fish that's out of water wants to get back in the water. They're flapping around, not because they like flapping. It's because they're trying to find some peace. I can't make the world just be peaceful, but I have to find peace with myself in a temporary world.
Does that relate to that sense of oneness? Like, I don't know this for a fact, but I feel like a fish in an aquarium kind of probably knows what is the ocean without actually knowing. Like, it knows it's out there and it exists. A bit like we know that there's this, you know, thing that we haven't maybe experienced that's greater than us. We know it's there. I feel like there's this, even throughout and in nature, this sense of everything is so connected that even if we're disconnected, we have that sense of loneliness and longing for something we might even not really be clear on what it is.
I like that. I like that. Yeah. I like that analogy. I might steal it. The fish in the aquarium knows of the ocean. I think that's true.
I mean,
I'm going to meditate on that a little.
Okay. You let me know.
Yeah, yeah, I'll let you know. I'll come back to you. See if we're going to keep that and polish it or if we're going to just shoot it down.
Yeah. That's good. That's good. Anything else you want to add about the story, about our journeys of transformation or soul searching? If there's like one takeaway you'd like listeners to leave our conversation today, what would that be?
Life moves really quick and create an urgency. You might not have an urgency, but there is an urgency in our spiritual life because life is short. We only get a few years. When we're little, we're absorbed in playing. Then there's a time of life where we're in school and we're sort of in busyness. And then there's work mode and survival mode. And then there's old age where we get some chronic sickness, perhaps. There's a little window where we can take this very seriously. Take it seriously. It's got the biggest return on investment. Because when you add spirit to your life, both the good times and even the tragedies have value. They carry meaning. Matter of fact, a lot of our growth comes from happening in those tragic moments. A lot of my biggest growth spurts happened in tragedy, as you will read in my book.
Yeah, I think that's a good takeaway for people to leave with and think about for a little bit. I will put all your information in the show notes. Obviously, we'll put the link of the book. But in the meantime, where's the best place for people to find you, to find the podcast, to find the book, if they want to learn more from you?
Anywhere you get podcasts and YouTube, you can just search for Wisdom of the Sages. It's daily, but some people like to binge listen to podcasts.
What a commitment to do that daily.
There's so many people that have never missed an episode. It's unbelievable. I don't believe it. And that, it's not only that, that there's people out there, we call them the others. We don't see them, but they're listening somewhere. But then because we started this as a morning class on Zoom and just my students would log on. So we wanted to keep that type of freshness where I'm looking at people. So every day there's between, 100 plus people that are on there and they're on there every day.
It's like their Dharma talk of the morning, part of their sadhana.
It's unbelievable, their dedication. But even if you just check in for a little bit, you can do that. And if you ever want to travel with me, my favorite thing is I create sort of spiritual adventures. And it was from my spiritual adventure when I first went to India, is I take people to holy places in India.
Where's the next one?
The next one I do is in October, when we're going to all holy cities in India. Jagannath Puri, Udaipur, Nathdwar, Vrindavan, Rishikesh, Haridwar, special trip. And then also right after that, you can go to both or you can go to just one of them. We're going trekking through Nepal. And so I teach during the travels, et cetera. So it's not just like we're sightseeing. It's not just like we're backpacking. We're meant to be on a pilgrimage of our consciousness, sort of a growth trip. So it's good. It's good.
Sort of.
We're not going to Vegas. That's for sure. It's nothing like that.
Yeah.
I will say, besides being like educational, it's deeply fun and joyous too. We do kirtan everywhere and sing. You can just look at my Instagram page because you can find the pilgrimages where we just have kirtans in the streets and blow people's minds. Yeah. And then we do a training in January, which is where we just sort of park it. And we do a 200-hour and 300-hour yoga training. Or we do a study of kirtan for people who want to study how to learn kirtan and lead kirtans. And then we do our podcast, does a wisdom training where we study sacred literature. And that all happens. It's all on my website, raghunath.yoga.
And we'll link that in the show notes for you guys to find it easily. Is the yoga teacher training based in bhakti?
We cover everything from alignment, vinyas, flow, pranayama. But yeah, the basis of it is in bhakti yoga teachings.
So much going on.
Yeah, I've got a lot going on. I got to prune down, but it's good stuff. So I feel good about what I'm doing.
Yeah. Thank you for doing what you're doing in this world. Thank you for your time today. That was a lovely chat.
Thank you so much. Keep up the good work. Looking forward to coming to Costa Rica visit.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you haven't already done so, please leave a review for this podcast or this episode on iTunes, as this really, really, really helps other people find it. And you can help other sensitive souls and yogis on their journey. You'll find the show notes for this episode at ericabelanger.com/223. Before you go, I just want to say a last thank you to the growing team behind this podcast and their support in making this possible. And this includes all our premium members. Thank you so much, guys. I would not be doing this without you. Once again, thank you for listening. I'll see you next Monday.